Chapter 55. Mary was quick to decide upon her choice of book. In Mr. Gardiner's library, she found the volumes of Mrs. Macaulay's History of England, which had so enthralled her when she first discovered them at Longbourn. She could not help but notice, as she opened them, that they did not look as though they had been much read. But then Mr. Gardiner, unlike her father, had a business to run, and perhaps preferred less demanding fare in his leisure hours. He certainly raised no objection when she asked if she might borrow them. She bore them off in triumph to her room, looking forward to the moment when she should present them to Mr. Haywood. A few days later, she and Mrs. Gardiner were sitting in the drawing-room when his name was announced. The children, who were supposed to be reading, leapt up with excitement, for Mr. Haywood was known to carry peppermints with him on his visits, and once, on an occasion that was never to be forgotten, had presented each of them with an entire candied orange. Mary was almost as excited as the young gardeners, as their mother could not help but observe. "You look very expectant," she remarked. "Are you hoping Tom might have sweets for you as well?" "Oh, no. It is something far better than that. Mr. Haywood and I have set ourselves a little task. He is to read a book of my choosing, and I am to read one of his." Mrs. Gardiner frowned. "Poor Tom. I suspect he has drawn the worst of the deal. I hope you are not planning to give him anything too indigestible." "Only Mrs. Macaulay's history," replied Mary airily, "and just 2 volumes, so he has nothing to fear." As Mr. Haywood strode into the room, still innocent of what awaited him, he was assailed on all sides by the children begging to know what he had brought them. "Ah," he said, "it was really too bad. He had intended to bring lemon drops, but had forgot them. He had meant to pick up some pralines, but they had slipped his mind. Had thought to buy sherbets, but had been distracted. He could only hope they would forgive him." Then, just as they began to think they were really to be disappointed, he pulled from his pocket a very large bag of sugar plums, which sent them happily away to the corner of the room, where they consumed their booty in silent satisfaction.
"You spoil them, Tom."
Mr. Haywood shrugged good-naturedly and sat down upon one of Mrs. Gardiner's pale sofas. "I am come to learn what fate Miss Bennet has in store for me. You will have heard about the task we have set each other?"
"Yes, I understand you are contracted to it, and that there is no escape for you now."
Mary leapt up eagerly.
"I wondered if we might begin with my choice," she said. "I have it waiting for you upstairs."
Mr. Haywood said he would be delighted, and Mary rushed to her room to bring down Mrs. Macaulay. When she placed it on the table in front of him, Mr. Haywood's face fell.
"Come, Miss Bennet, what is this?"
2 volumes.
"We agreed on 1 book, singular, as I recall."
"Yes, you're quite right, but I hoped I might persuade you to read the chapters on the Civil War. I long to hear your opinion on what she has to say about it, and I'm afraid half the story is in 1 volume and half in the other."
Mr. Haywood picked up the 2 volumes and held them in his hands, as if weighing up whether to accept them or not.
I'm not sure that doesn't amount to a breach of our agreement."
"But surely," Mary protested, "it's true to the spirit of what we intended, even if not to the letter of the law."
"I think you'll find it is the letter of the thing that counts, as far as the law is concerned," observed Mr. Haywood dryly.
He replaced the books carefully on the table, rose from the sofa, and walked to the long window, staring out into the street with a very severe expression.
"I must consider my position, Miss Bennet, if you will grant me a moment."
Mary knew he was teasing, but was too excited to indulge him any further.
"Oh, please say you'll read it."
"Indeed, I believe you must," interjected Mrs. Gardiner, "if you want to show yourself up as a man of feeble spirit and no powers of concentration."
"Very well," declared Mr. Haywood. "I throw myself upon the mercy of this honourable court. I undertake to read the chapters up to and including the restoration of Charles II, but nothing further."
He held out his hand to Mary, and after a moment's hesitation, she shook it. It was 10 days before Mr. Hayward returned, bringing with him the 2 volumes of Mrs. Macaulay, a notebook full of jottings, and peppermints for the children. Mr. Gardiner had agreed they might have use of his library, and for the rest of the afternoon, Mary and Mr. Hayward were closeted there, discussing what he'd read. At first, Mrs. Gardiner called in upon them now and then to offer them tea and see how Mr. Hayward was bearing up. But each time she did so, she found them either deep in discussion of the role of church and state, or arguing animatedly about the guilt of Charles I or the virtues of Oliver Cromwell. Having satisfied herself that Mr. Hayward was in no need of rescuing, and indeed seemed to be enjoying himself quite as much as Mary, she decided to leave them alone. They did not emerge until Mr. Gardiner appeared at the library door to tell them it would shortly be time for dinner, and that he assumed Tom would join them. When they sat down at the table, Mary felt as invigorated as if she had just finished a long and very breezy country walk.
"So, Tom," said Mr. Gardiner as he carved the beef at the head of the table, "you appear to have survived your encounter with Mrs. Macaulay."
"I don't think he found her anywhere near as tedious as he expected," declared Mary, glancing at Mr. Hayward with a triumphant air. "He certainly entered into a very lively discussion of her work."
"You must never forget," remarked Mrs. Gardiner, "that Tom is trained to argue. It might be said that debate is his calling, so we should expect him to be good at it."
Mr. Hayward put down his knife and fork. "I cannot let that pass, ma'am. This was a purely private encounter, nothing in the professional line at all. I argued with Miss Bennet purely for the love of it." He smiled at her over the dish of peas and carrots that was making its way down the table, and Mary felt happiness flood through her as she placed a spoonful of each on her plate. She hoped her pleasure was not as apparent to the others as it was to herself. "It was an excellent recommendation," continued Mr. Hayward, "because it reminded me not only that Mrs. Macaulay is singularly well informed, but that she marshals her facts with admirable skill."
"I suppose that counts as praise," remarked Mr. Gardiner, "if not of the most effusive kind."
Mr. Hayward attacked his beef and declined to reply.
"You have obviously been much improved by it," observed Mrs. Gardiner. "I cannot wait to hear what task you intend to offer Mary."
Everyone turned in her direction, but this time Mary did not look away as she might once have done.
"I hope I'll be able to rise to your challenge with as much enthusiasm as you have to mine."
"Well said," cried Mr. Gardiner. "That's the spirit."
"I've already chosen the work," said Mr. Hayward, "and it is of a rather different nature to Mrs. Macaulay. It speaks less to the intellect than to the emotions."
"I see. And shall I enjoy it, do you think?"
"I will deliver it to you later this week, so you won't have to wait too long to find out." As they ate their lemon posset, Mary did all she could to persuade Mr. Hayward to divulge the title of his choice, but he would not be drawn. And by the time coffee was served, she had resigned herself to its remaining a surprise. She very much hoped it might turn out not to be poetry, but she thought it very probable that it would. The next day, a package arrived for her. As she carried it to her room, it did not feel heavy enough to be a novel, let alone something more scholarly. Her heart sank. There seemed little doubt it must be verse. She pulled out the small volume and opened it. Lyrical Ballads by W. Wordsworth. It was a name she recognized, but she had never read anything of his. She frowned slightly as she turned the pages. Between them, she found a note. "My dear Miss Bennet, I have no doubt your worst suspicions are confirmed now that you hold my choice of book in your hands. I urge you, however, not to give in to first impressions, but to persevere with the same energy with which I tackled Mrs. Macaulay. Mr. Wordsworth is, in my opinion, the greatest poet now living in England. He very much deserves your unprejudiced attention, which I beg you will extend to him. I should not presume to suggest which poem you should read first, or with most care. Any of them will well repay the time spent in their company. Some do not give up their meaning easily, but if you approach them with an open, generous mind, I think you cannot fail to be affected by them. Remember what I said, that this is writing for the heart, not the head. That may be unfamiliar or even at first unwelcome to you, but I do not doubt you have it within you to appreciate it. Time will prove if I am right. Thomas Hayward. Mary held the book in her hands, struck by the directness of Mr. Hayward's words. She thought of him saying them in person, his grey eyes fixed upon her, for she was aware now that his eyes were grey, and imagined the playful tone in which he would have spoken. But this would not do. This was no way to think. She picked up her shawl and wrapped it tightly around her. She did not look forward to the task before her. She thought it was unlikely she should enjoy Mr. Wordsworth's poems, but it was her duty to read them, with the open, generous spirit which Mr. Hayward had urged upon her. She would do her best to satisfy his request, and would begin tomorrow. Chapter 56. Mary spent most of the next few days alone in Mr. Gardiner's library, studying the lyrical ballads. At tea time one afternoon, when her aunt came searching for her, she was so deeply immersed in her reading that, when Mrs. Gardiner gently touched her shoulder, she sprang up in surprise.
"I'm so sorry, Mary," exclaimed her aunt. "I didn't mean to alarm you. You must be quite lost to the world in that book."
She looked over at the title.
"Oh, it is poetry, then, just as you feared. How are you finding it?"
"Some of the poems are quite simple to grasp and easy to enjoy, but others puzzle me. I have read them over and over, but I still don't know what to think of them."
"That must be a new sensation for you, I imagine?" asked Mrs. Gardiner, noting Mary's preoccupied air.
There was no point in asking her to take a view on young George's attempt at copying out the alphabet. Her mind was elsewhere.
"I should warn you, a confession of that nature will be irresistible to Tom. He will explain them to you at great length, from now until dinner time, unless you keep him in check."
Mary smiled politely and went back to the little book. She was not sure that explanation, in the usual sense, would be of much help to her. She had begun to suspect that the more opaque poems were not susceptible to analysis at all, or at least not of the rational kind she knew best. They seemed to ask something very different from their reader. She was not sure yet exactly what it was, but she would do all she could to discover it. She was determined to have something intelligent to say to Mr. Hayward when he came to discuss them. He arrived on a sunny Saturday morning, freed from his office and eager to talk of something other than the law. Mrs. Gardiner was occupied with the children in the nursery upstairs, and Mr. Gardiner was occupied with writing letters in his library, so he and Mary had the drawing-room to themselves. Mr. Hayward looked around, as if something was not quite to his liking, before boldly lifting one of the several card tables scattered about the room and placing it in front of the high windows. When he had satisfied himself that it was now in the perfect position to take best advantage of the sharp morning light, he drew up two chairs at either side. From the sideboard, Mary fetched the jug of lemon water she had arranged to be there for their use, and soon they were both seated comfortably at the table, each with a copy of the lyrical ballads in their hands.
"This reminds me a little of preparing for my examinations," remarked Mr. Hayward. "So, where shall we start? How did you like the ballads?"
"I began rather slowly," said Mary. "I did not realise before that poetry requires a special kind of concentration all of its own. I had to learn how to read them properly before I could begin to think of enjoying them."
"Yes, a poem demands a particular kind of effort, if it is to be appreciated. But I cannot believe you did not persevere."
"Yes, I did. And I was rewarded, for there were many poems that pleased me. The simpler ones, those about humble people." She opened the book and began to turn the pages. "I very much liked We Are Seven. No one could fail to be moved by it if they had any feeling heart." She found the place and began to read.
Their graves are green, they may be seen, the little maid replied. 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. My stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit, and sing a song to them. She looked up, her eyes bright. It is very affecting, is it not? But there were others which, as you hinted to me, did not give up their secrets so easily. I had to read them again and again before I began to understand their meaning. She reached for her glass and filled it with lemon water from the jug. Her hand trembled very slightly as she did so. She knew, once she began to describe what had happened, the great discovery she had made, she would find it hard to stop.
But oh, Mr. Hayward, when you finally understand, when a poem speaks to you at last, as one did to me last night, it is wonderful, is it not?
She longed to describe to him how it happened, the flash of insight that had come upon her unawares as she lay reading in bed, the excitement she had felt in understanding what the poet intended, the way she had hugged herself with the sheer pleasure of seeing it at last. But this was too much to be said, even to Mr. Hayward.
So poetry has touched you, then, he replied with a playful smile. It has broken through that rational reserve.
It is unfair to mock me, sir, and very ungenerous, too.
Yes, I am wrong to do so, he admitted, his amused expression gradually becoming more serious now. In truth, I am delighted for you. You have experienced a sensation I know I could not live without, and I am exceedingly happy for you. Will you tell me which poem it was that affected you so strongly?
She turned to a page marked with a piece of paper.
It is this one.
She reached across the table and handed the book silently to him.
Tintern Abbey.
He looked up and their eyes met.
How extraordinary that this should be your favourite.
It is mine, too. I like it best of all Mr. Wordsworth's works. In the distance she heard the muffled rumble of the city streets. Upstairs the children ran around in the nursery, their footsteps loud on the wooden floors. The drawing-room, in contrast, seemed remarkably still. In the silence she was suddenly very aware of Mr. Hayward's presence, of his hands holding the book, the whiteness of his cuffs against his dark coat.
I am very pleased, he said softly, that we think as one about this poem, that it moves you as much as it does me. But I am not surprised. I think you have it within you to feel very deeply when you allow yourself to do so.
Mary was at a loss to know what to say or how to answer. From the street she heard the cry of a woman selling cherries from her barrow.
Round and sound, 5 pence a pound!
Her voice was pure, clear, and very loud. Mr. Hayward started up and seemed to recollect himself. He handed the book back to Mary, drew his own copy from his pocket, and turned its pages until he found Tintern Abbey. Before we talk about the poem itself, he said in a more even tone, I should be interested to know what happened to make you appreciate its power.
Mary considered his question.
In the past, her instinct would have been to say nothing, to reveal as little as possible of her private self. But now, with a new courage, she resolved to be candid.
I suppose it is my habit to dissect and analyse what I read, she began. Indeed, it is how I make sense of things in general. But with Tintern Abbey, it did not work. No matter how hard I tried, I could not get to the heart of it. Something always eluded me.
She shifted in her chair. Perhaps the bodice of her new dress was a little tight. Suddenly she felt very warm, but she continued.
Then it occurred to me that I was coming at it in quite the wrong way. I was belabouring it with my mind, trying to think it into submission. I began to fear I might be about to destroy the very thing I wanted to understand. It struck me that a poem was perhaps too fragile an object to bear the weight of too much rational examination. She ran her fingers across the smooth cotton of her dress, playing with the pleats as she spoke. I must say, I was not entirely pleased with that idea. It was very unsettling. If I could not call upon my intellect to help me make sense of things, what else was there for me to rely upon?
So what did you do?
I made the hardest possible choice for someone like myself. I left it alone. I stopped examining and underlining. I made no more notes in the margins. I allowed myself to do nothing more than to read and quietly reflect upon it. And then, a few days later, when I least expected it, I made the leap. That is the only way I can explain it.
Ah, yes, cried Mr. Hayward.
The leap. I know exactly what you mean. It is the moment when we enter fully into the poet's imagination, when we truly understand what it is he means.
Yes, replied Mary quietly. That is what happened. It was a very surprising sensation for me, unlike anything I have experienced before.
You should be very pleased with yourself, declared Mr. Hayward excitedly. Many people never manage to make such a connection. I long to know which parts of it particularly affected you. Tell me exactly what you felt when you read it.
Mary took another glass of water and tried to compose herself. She wanted to make no mistakes. She opened her book at the marked page and began. At first, the poem seems both very beautiful and very simple. The poet sits beneath a tree at the top of a high valley, gazing down to the river below.
O sylvan Wye, murmured Mr. Hayward, thou wanderer through the woods.
Mary noticed he did not consult his book. He knew the poem by heart. Mr. Wordsworth describes the landscape with great brilliance. We feel ourselves plunged into the heart of the wild, secluded scene. Mr. Hayward did not hurry her, so she took a deep breath and continued. All this is excellently done. But just as we think we have the measure of what the poet wants to say, we realise he has something far more extraordinary to convey to us. She turned the pages of her book, her excitement growing. We begin to understand that the landscape he has conjured up so brilliantly is not merely a view to be admired. It is far more than that. It is nothing less than the means by which we may connect ourselves to a higher truth. If we will only allow ourselves to surrender to its beauty, it will transform us, for then we will leave behind the weary weight of all this unintelligible world and become what we are meant to be, a living soul. She was speaking faster, exuberant with the thrill of understanding. That is it not? That is what Mr. Wordsworth means to show us. How through nature we become one with the world, how we become a living soul.
Yes, yes, declared Mr. Hayward, as animated now as Mary. He reveals to us how we see into the life of things. You have it, Miss Bennet. You have it, indeed.
He sat back in his chair, much affected. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but really I could not resist. He stood up abruptly and went to the window where he stood looking into the street. Mary sat quite still, hugely elated and a little shocked. Neither of them spoke until Mr. Hayward returned to the table and took his seat again.
I told you a while ago, Miss Bennet, that you were full of surprises. But I did not expect you to astonish me again so quickly.
She allowed herself to bask in his praise for a moment, aware of the admiration with which he regarded her, and this emboldened her to make a final disclosure.
You asked me to tell you what I felt when I read the poem, sir. I hope I may confess the truth to you without seeming foolish. But, oh, Mr. Hayward, it made me long to become a living soul myself.
She was not sure how he would respond to such an intimate declaration. She very much hoped he would not be playful or satiric, for she did not think she could bear that. But when he spoke, she saw with gratitude it was with all the seriousness she had hoped for.
That is the power of poetry, he said simply.
It allows us to imagine ourselves anew
if we will permit it to do so. It reveals to us the hidden wishes of our hearts. From the street, the sound of the cherry seller's barrow could be heard once more as she pushed it over the cobbles, making her way back to Cheapside. She did not call out this time. Had she sold all her wares, wondered Mary, or was she simply too tired to cry them again? It was a melancholy thought, and it darkened her mood. "Yes, it shows us those things," she replied. "But what if we cannot act upon them? What if it inspires in us longings we can never achieve?"
"I'm not sure what you mean," said Mr. Hayward.
"There is nothing I should like more than to experience what Mr. Wordsworth describes," cried Mary. "But I cannot think it will ever happen for me. I have altogether the wrong sort of character for that."
"Why should you think that?"
"Mr. Wordsworth says elsewhere that nothing of value is to be gained from books. For him, our affections are the only real guide worth following." She felt tears begin to well up in her eyes.
"And I'm not sure I have any,
or none strong enough for me to follow with confidence. Perhaps they are too weak, too frozen to help me find my way."
Mr. Hayward gazed at her with such concern that for a moment Mary thought he was about to take her hand. But if that was his intention, he mastered it, and instead pulled the jug of lemon water towards him and filled both their glasses.
"I fear you are creating a difficulty where none need exist," he said, pushing the drink towards her. "Perhaps I may cite myself as proof of my argument."
He crossed his arms and looked at her across the table, both serious and fond at the same time.
"My passion for poetry is so strong that I know there are some, and I must include your aunt and uncle among them, who find it very amusing and just a little odd. But it has not diminished my appetite for other, very different authors. I do not think my love for Mr. Wordsworth requires me to give up my appreciation for, well, let us say my respect for Mrs. Macaulay. There is room for both in my life. The same is true for you, I believe."
Mary closed Lyrical Ballads and placed it gently on the table.
"It seems to me," he went on, "that in the real world it is impossible to be guided solely by either the impulses of feeling or by rational calculation. Neither is likely to make us happy. In my own view, we have need of them both. Wisdom, I suppose, lies in knowing when to call upon one and when on the other."
"I think you will always find that easier to achieve than I do," answered Mary. "You are accustomed to expressing your feelings. You have exercised them with poetry until they are robust and familiar to you. Mine, I often think, are feeble, frozen, and largely unknown to me."
Finally, Mr. Hayward smiled at her. "Excuse me if I insist, you are mistaken. No one who has spoken with the passion you have shown so freely this afternoon can possibly be a stranger to strong emotions."
Mary was suddenly mortified by the candour with which she had spoken.
"I have said far too much," she cried. "I am so sorry. I was carried away. I cannot believe I have been so forward."
"That is not how I regard it at all," said Mr. Hayward soothingly. "I beg you not to think of it in that way. You have nothing with which to reproach yourself. Our conversation has been invigorating and very illuminating. I should very much hope to read other poems with you. May I be allowed to suggest a few more?"
His expression was so inviting and so sincere that her embarrassment evaporated, and she knew there was nothing she would enjoy more.
"Yes," she replied simply. "I would like that very much."
"I intend to do all I can to help you become a woman of feeling," said Mr. Hayward lightly. "I shall unlock the sensibility buried beneath all that good sense. See if I do not."
Mary blushed, but more from surprise than delicacy. She was shocked to realize that she was not at all offended, and that indeed she rather hoped he would do so. After he had gone, she could not settle.
She felt excited, invigorated, alive. Not knowing what else to do with herself, she walked to the gardener's piano, lifted the lid, and for the first time in a long while, began to play. Upstairs in the nursery, Mrs. Gardiner heard the music as it echoed round the house, and was puzzled at first to think who could be playing. It was carried off with so much spirit and vigour that she did not think it could be Mary at the keyboard. When she realised it must be her, Mrs. Gardiner stood leaning on the door, wondering what had provoked such a change in attitude as the children danced about behind her. Chapter 57. Over the next week, Mrs. Gardiner made several cautious attempts to discover how Mary and Mr. Haywood had spent their afternoon together. But her niece deflected every mild inquiry and batted away every innocent question. Mary had barely allowed herself to dwell upon how pleasurable it had been, as she was not sure what she should conclude from Mr. Haywood's manner. Did his behaviour suggest that he enjoyed her company as much as she did his? It seemed probable, even likely, but beyond that, she would not go. She told herself she would not think about him too often, and for at least a few minutes a day, she was successful in this endeavour. For the rest of the time, however, he was very much in her mind. So it was that she was thinking of him one breakfast whilst around her the children ate their hot rolls and the gardeners drank their coffee. When the post was brought in, Mary took no notice, for there was never anything for her. It was only when her uncle held up a letter with every appearance of surprise that she paid attention.
"Here's a note from that quizzical young man, Tom Haywood. He asks a favour of me. You will never guess, my dear, in 100 years what it is."
"I'm sure I shall not," his wife agreed, spreading jam on the bread of her youngest daughter. "I hope you will tell me."
"He asks if I would be kind enough to bring Mary early one morning to Westminster Bridge, where he says he will meet us."
He turned to Mary, incredulous.
"He writes that he wishes to show you the city as the sun comes up and read us some lines about it."
Mary could not quite believe it, nor, it seemed, could Mr. Gardiner.
"What can he mean by it?" he asked his wife. "For such a respectable lawyer, he has some very strange ideas."
"I'm sure he imagines it as a treat," she replied, "an opportunity to see something remarkable. What do you think, Mary? Should you like to go?" "Well, it must be a very extraordinary sight," said Mary, trying to keep the eagerness out of her voice. "I should very much like to see it, if it won't inconvenience Mr. Gardiner." Her uncle shrugged.
"Of course I will take you if you wish it, but it's a very odd errand, and a very early one, too. Tom will owe me a bottle of claret in recompense."
"Well done, my dear," said her aunt. "It is a great kindness in you." "Does that mean we are to go?" asked Mary eagerly. "I believe it does," replied Mrs. Gardiner.
"There are times when I am astonished by my own magnanimity," declared Mr. Gardiner, as his wife offered him the last rasher of bacon.
It was still dark when, a few days later, Mary and her uncle made their way in a slow carriage through the early morning streets. Far from being deserted, the pavements were already filling up. Country people carrying baskets of fresh fruits and vegetables. Apprentices passed them with the tools of their trade wrapped in their aprons. In a side street, Mary thought she saw a dairymaid leading a cow.
"I had no idea, sir, that the city was so busy at this time."
"London starts work early. No one makes money by lying too long in bed."
When they arrived on the southern side of the bridge, Mr. Haywood was there waiting for them. He thanked Mr. Gardiner profusely for his kindness and hoped neither he nor Mary would be disappointed by their outing.
"Do I understand," asked Mr. Gardiner cautiously, "that you mean to read a poem?"
"Yes, sir, but I shall do so very quietly without drawing undue attention to us, and it is very short." Somewhat relieved, Mr. Gardiner put his hands into his pockets and walked a few steps away. Mary stared across the river at the city landscape spread out before them. The rising sun had just begun to appear above the roofs, touching everything with a thin rime of gold.
It is wonderful, Mr. Hayward. I wish I had the words to describe it.
I suggest we allow Mr. Wordsworth to say what we cannot, he said in a low voice. Now, what I ask of you, Miss Bennet, is not to think too much about what you feel as I read, but instead to allow the sensations to wash over you.
He drew a book from his pocket and began in a quiet, ordinary tone, without flourishes or affectation.
Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty.
As he went on, Mary gave herself up to the rhythm and beauty of the words and began to see the city through Wordsworth's eyes.
Ships, towers, domes, theatres, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air.
She leant on a parapet, staring at the view, the dark water below her, the church spires glinting beyond. It was like nothing she had ever seen before.
Ne'er saw I, never felt, a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Mr. Hayward closed his book and stood staring for a moment into the dawn-flecked cityscape. When the sun finally cleared the rooftops, he turned to look at her.
This is sensation, is it not? He declared. Do not tell me your feelings are not aroused by it, that it has not stimulated your mind to awe and admiration.
Oh, but it has, truly it has. Mary replied. I am amazed, speechless.
They both took one last long look at the view. Mr. Hayward sighed and put the book back in his pocket. It is one of the most remarkable experiences I know, he said, as they walked back to the carriage, where Mr. Gardiner stood talking quietly to the coachman. I saw it first when I was little more than a lad, just up from Hampshire.
An image of him as a lanky, excited boy flashed in Mary's mind's eye. It was not hard to imagine him standing on the bridge, declaiming Wordsworth silently to himself in the early dawn light. She looked at him from the corner of her eye, taking in his animated, intelligent expression. They were nearly at the carriage now, but before they reached it, he stopped and bent his head to her ear.
I hope that encourages you to accept that your capacity to feel is as strong as anyone's, he said quietly. You need not fear that you are, in any way, dull of soul. That is not you at all.
He held the door open for her, and soon they were all inside, heading back to Gracechurch Street. Mr. Hayward was invited back for breakfast. He readily accepted. Then no more was said. Mr. Gardiner closed his eyes. Mr. Hayward sat preoccupied, seemingly lost in thought, and Mary stared silently from the carriage window at the streets as they passed. She felt quite unlike herself, both very close to the world outside and at the same time distantly remote from it, as though she was regarding it from the wrong end of a telescope. It was not until they were back in the breakfast room, being served with everything hungry people could possibly require, that she began to return to her usual state of mind. Mrs. Gardiner sat at the table, watching them eat.
Was it as remarkable as you expected it to be? She asked Mary. Was it worth getting up so early?
Oh, indeed it was, exclaimed Mary. It was a wonderful thing to see, to know that we stood where Mr. Wordsworth stood, looked at the very scene that had inspired his words. What is it like, Mr. Hayward, to do the same in the lakes? It must be very splendid to stand in that wild landscape, reading his poems in its midst.
I am sure it is, replied Mr. Haywood, but I'm afraid I would not know. I am sorry to say I have never been there, but though I have often promised myself the pleasure of a visit.
But that is so sad, exclaimed Mary. The lakes interest you so much. It seems very unfair you should not have seen them.
I have no one to blame for that but myself, replied Mr. Haywood. I have allowed my work to keep me here in London, with the result that I have yet to set foot in the countryside I most wish to visit.
I too long to see the lakes, said Mrs. Gardiner. We once planned a trip there. Indeed, we actually set out, but at the last moment Mr. Gardiner's business obliged us to cut short our time, and we got no further than Derbyshire. There was a brief silence, whilst everyone considered how much they regretted never having beheld the grandeur of the northern hills, crags, and lakes. Then Mr. Gardiner reached across the table and gently took his wife's hand.
I have always been sorry that you did not get your wish. I think the time has come to put that right. The days are beginning to lengthen. What do you say to an expedition to the lakes as soon as it is possible for us to leave? I am not too much occupied with business just now, so I do believe it might be done. And fortune favours the brave, they say.
Mrs. Gardiner rose from her chair, hurried round the table, and kissed her husband on both cheeks.
If you really think it can be managed, there's nothing I should like better.
Delighted at the success of his suggestion, he could not imagine why he had not thought of it before. Mr. Gardiner now wanted nothing more than to see everyone around him as happy as he was himself.
Mary, you will accompany us, of course, and Tom, if the law can spare you for a short while, I hope you will come too.
Mr. Haywood said he would be honoured to join them if it could be arranged, and soon he and Mr. Gardiner were deep in conversation, discussing dates, itineraries, and the best way of making the journey.
What an unexpected treat, exclaimed Mrs. Gardiner. I cannot quite believe we are to go at last. I wonder if Jane would be happy to take the children for a short while. It would not be much to their liking to travel so far and nothing but mountains at the end of it. But you seem very quiet, Mary. Don't you want to come? More than anything. But you have already been so kind to me. I must ask, are you certain you want me with you?
Really, said her aunt, giving her a little embrace, how should we manage without you? You can keep us entertained on the long road north. You're sure to be able to point out all manner of curious rocks and historical ruins.
Mrs. Gardiner reached out and took the last roll left on the plate.
And Tom will be able to show us all the scenes that inspired the poetry of the place. Between the pair of you, we shall be excellently supplied with information. It will be hardly worthwhile buying a guidebook.
Chapter 58. Mr. Haywood and Mary were much in each other's company over the next few weeks. He was often at Gracechurch Street, sometimes calling briefly to pay his respects and drink a glass of Mr. Gardiner's wine, sometimes dining with the family on terms of such familiarity that he seemed to belong there as much as Mary herself. At first, Mary had wondered whether, after their conversation about Tintern Abbey, she would feel self-conscious and a little uneasy in his presence. She had talked to him with more freedom and honesty than to any man she knew, revealing aspects of herself she had confessed to no one else. When they had spoken together, it seemed the most natural thing in the world to be so open, but now part of her blushed to think of it, as if she'd shown him her petticoat. And she wondered when he came to reflect upon it if he would come to regret his own candour. It was soon apparent that none of her fears were justified. There was no breach in their cheerful relations. On the contrary, their intimacy deepened as they became more familiar with each other, as they chatted together on the sofa or sat alongside each other at dinner, talking and laughing. At first, Mary congratulated herself on having found so good a friend and strove not to imagine anything more. She told herself she was grateful to have found a like-minded confidant with whom she shared so many interests and whose conversation was more interesting to her than that of any other man she had known.
But as time went on, Mary gradually understood that her affection for Mr. Hayward went beyond that of friendship. She waited for his visits with keen anticipation and felt a little rush of pleasure when she heard his name announced. When he smiled at her in a particular way all his own, when he commented approvingly on something she said, when he told a story that made her laugh, and above all, when his hand once grazed her own as he handed her a book. Then she knew without a doubt that these were feelings of an altogether different kind. She kept this new knowledge strictly to herself. Mrs. Gardiner was not blind to their liking for each other, and did not object to it, for she loved them both, and thought them admirably suited to each other. But when she attempted to gauge Mary's feelings in the matter, Mary would not be drawn out. She merely replied that she was always pleased to see Mr. Hayward, which was indeed the truth. The rest she kept resolutely to herself. She feared if she confessed her liking, it might somehow imply she thought it was returned, and this seemed in every way presumptuous, as well as unfamiliar. But there were times, however, even when she was inclined to think she caught a glimpse of something warmer in his behaviour, a look, a gesture, or a remark that suggested emotions on his part which went beyond those of friendship. But she could not be sure, and a small voice from deep within her sometimes whispered it was impossible a man like Mr. Hayward should take a serious interest in a woman like herself. It spoke lower than it once did, but it cautioned her to say nothing at present. So she did not share her hopeful feelings with her aunt, but kept them all to herself, to be enjoyed in private until such time as she was convinced it was safe enough to declare them. Spring was well advanced when Mr. Gardiner announced one evening that he had arranged a great surprise for them all.
"I thought our journey to the lakes was excitement enough," replied Mrs. Gardiner.
"Oh, this is more by way of a local excursion. Does anyone want to guess what it might be?"
The children ran about, shouting louder with each suggestion. A visit to the lions at the Tower, a trip to feed the Queen zebras at Buckingham House. When Mr. Hayward arrived, he wondered if it might be a climb to the top of the monument, a prospect greeted by the younger gardeners with markedly less enthusiasm, or perhaps an afternoon's indulgence at Mr. Birch's pastry shop, which was far more favourably received.
"None of you have it, I'm afraid," said Mr. Gardiner. "So I will tell you. The Vauxhall Gardens open next week for the season, and I have tickets for all of us to attend. We shall see the fountains, hear a little music, and enjoy a good supper. You children may have as many pastries as you can eat without being sick, and if you're very lucky, I shall take you to see the tightrope walkers before we go home."
This exceeded the children's wildest expectations, and their joy was noisily unconfined.
When were they to go? Tomorrow? The next day? They had heard there was a dog that juggled, stood on its hind legs. Should they see him too?
Amidst the clamour, Mr. Hayward was obliged to raise his voice when he tried, for the second time, to make himself heard.
"Were you ever in Vauxhall, Miss Bennet?"
Mary admitted she never had been. "There's nowhere else like it. It's London in a nutshell, loud and glittering, a little rough round the edges, crowded and gaudy. I like it very much."
"I understand you can see every kind of spectacle there."
"Everything you have ever thought of, and much you have not. There's a vast great pavilion in the Chinese style, elegant covered walks to stroll along, comedies and plays to watch, dancing if you chose to join in, even its own romantic ruins, built to look as though they've always been there. It has everything a Londoner's heart could possibly desire."
"And dancing dogs," added George.
"Dancing horses, too," agreed Mr. Hayward.
"And I saw a pig there once who could tell the time." "Really, Miss Bennet, how can you resist?"
"You cannot think of yourself as a Londoner until you've seen it," declared Mr. Gardiner,
at which the children began to argue about which of them most longed to go and who should enjoy it more than anyone else. And it was not until their father rapped the table sharply with a spoon and pretended to look fierce that order was at length restored. A few days later, Mary and her aunt were once more to be found shopping at Harding and Howell. Mrs. Gardiner had decided that it was impossible to venture to Vauxhall without equipping themselves with new hats, and now they sat before a large tray of ribbons, examining them closely. They had decided upon their hats with relative ease. It was the dressing of them that proved more difficult. Mary was weighing in her mind the relative virtues of green and pink trimmings, thinking how much she would value Mr. Hayward's advice on such a weighty matter, when she heard a voice from the next counter that could not be mistaken.
"I'm afraid none of these is at all satisfactory.
Is this all you have to show me?"
A tall female figure sat with its back to her, rigid with displeasure.
"It is most disappointing."
The shopman, disinclined to help further, gathered up his samples, clearly hoping his next customer would prove easier to please. The woman rose to leave, much affronted. Mary looked quickly down at her ribbons, desperate not to catch her eye. Mary had no desire to be recognised by Caroline Bingley, especially not when she was so cross. Who could guess what she might say to relieve her frustrations if a likely victim presented herself? Mary averted her face until the imperious rustle of a silk dress told her it was safe to look up. When she did so, Mrs. Gardiner was coolly watching the other woman's departure.
"I do believe that was Miss Bingley who has just made such a flouncing, ill-natured exit."
"Yes, I'm afraid so. She is not at her best when she considers herself thwarted."
"I was about to observe, it is surprising she did not have the courtesy to let you know she was in London. But I suppose that is quite in character for her. She and her sister came to visit us when Jane was staying in Gracechurch Street, and her manner was most superior. She is a most disobliging person."
"It is true, she has a talent for unpleasantness," Mary replied. "It is very painful to find oneself on the receiving end of it."
"Then we should be pleased she has not deigned to notice us, as now we shan't be required to spend any time in her company. I am sure that is a great relief to us both. Now, how are you coming along with those ribbons?"
Impatient with her own indecision, Mary quickly chose the green over the pink. But whether because Mr. Hayward had once expressed a preference for that colour, or simply because it was closer to hand than the pink, she found it impossible to say. Chapter 59. Although the children had begun to think it would never happen, the night of the Vauxhall excursion came around at last. When they finally set out, the little gardeners could barely contain themselves. Even the journey there excited them, for it involved a rare trip across Westminster Bridge to the city's southern side. This was a treat in itself, and there was much cheering and hallooing as the carriage made its way over the Thames. Shortly afterwards, they were dropped off at the tall iron gates which marked the entrance to the gardens, and were quickly absorbed into the large crowd of well-dressed visitors who milled around, waiting to be joined by tardy friends and family. It was some time before they caught sight of Mr. Hayward, deftly making his way towards them through the knots of people, looking like a man with every expectation of enjoying himself. Once they had shaken hands, kissed cheeks, rumpled the children's hair, in short, had done everything necessary to signal their readiness to embrace all that the gardens had to offer, they headed to the great turnstile, where upon presenting their tickets, they were admitted to the cool green park within. Once inside, they found themselves walking on gravel paths through avenues of high trees towards a spacious, elegant square, lined on each side by four stately colonnades. In the centre, on a little plinth, strung all about with tiny lights, an orchestra played. At one side of the small stage stood a statue of Handel, above which a single lamp was hung so that it appeared to illuminate his genius. Around them strolled other visitors, families, friends, couples, all in their best clothes and determined to appear as smart and as at their ease as possible. It was clearly not done to look too impressed by the surroundings. Only a bumpkin would gape and stare. But Mary had never seen anything like it and was not afraid to express her wonder.
"Oh, it is so beautifully done! The effect of the trees and the vistas they produce is truly lovely.
and the sound of the music in the open air is wonderful.
It was a fine evening, still warm and light enough to explore the woodland walks, where their little company marvelled at the music that accompanied them wherever they went.
There are musicians stationed all around us so that there is always something pleasing to hear,
explained Mr. Gardiner, who, as an old stalwart of the gardens, considered it his duty to supply such information to those less familiar with their pleasures. He led them towards the rotunda, a huge circular building with an elaborately painted interior.
It can seat 2,000 persons,
he declared proudly. His wife added, in an aside to Mary, that it was intended to provide patrons with somewhere to shelter from the rain. But Mr. Gardiner seemed to feel this detracted from its dignity and looked faintly affronted.
I suppose that might be said of anywhere with a roof that does not leak. But this splendid place has a far greater claim to fame. It has been the scene of many extraordinary performances by the most notable artists. It was here, my dear, that we saw the incomparable Anna Maria Leary sing. Do you recall it?
Oh, indeed I do, replied Mrs. Gardiner, lost in remembrance. The Siren of Vauxhall. What a talent she was.
There were, however, no concerts to be heard that night. Instead, they watched a display of horsemanship, extremely well done, and a remarkable acrobatic exhibition on a tightrope, which thrilled all who watched it. But in the opinion of the children, neither could compete with what followed. This was the performance they had dreamt of, featuring a trio of dancing dogs, two of whom stood on their hind legs, whilst the third caught oranges in his mouth, which was worth the price of admission on its own. By the time Mr. Gardiner had walked them round the gushing fountains, it was almost time for dinner, and they began to make their way to the supper boxes where it would be served. Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner walked in front, shepherding their children before them, and Mary followed behind with Mr. Hayward. To entertain them on their walk, Mr. Hayward, who was in high spirits, set himself the task of inventing imaginary characters for the visitors whom they passed on the crowded path. There, he whispered, nodding discreetly towards an overdressed gentleman whose finery looked shabbier with every step that drew him closer to them, is Lord So-and-so, an unlucky gambler living off his expectations at very much the wrong end of Brook Street, with a single blackguardly manservant. He's here tonight looking for some wealthy widow who'll fall gratefully into his arms and provide him with the income he knows he deserves. Mary felt a little guilty as she laughed. Really, Mr. Hayward, for shame. I'm sure he is a most respectable person.
Not with that hat and waistcoat. Both suggest a man capable of the most desperate acts. Very unlike the large family making so much noise to our left, who, I suggest, are exactly what they seem to be. Up from the country, Somerset, by their accents, on their yearly jaunt to town, where they are fleeced mercilessly at every turn, but greet every new outrage with the greatest good humour. I believe they're relations of Squire Allworthy. Don't they remind you of him?
I'm afraid I don't know the Allworthys, sir. Are they acquaintances of yours?
Only through Mr. Fielding's great book. Have you not read Tom Jones, Miss Bennet?
I'm afraid not, Mary said, a little ashamed to be so exposed. I'm not well acquainted with fiction, as I believe I told you.
Yes, but not to know Fielding when you know so much else.
Your reading is like a two-edged stool, well supplied in some respects and completely deficient in others.
I see we must add some novels to our reading scheme.
Her discomfort at having the gaps in her knowledge shown up was instantly expunged by pleasure at his suggestion he would be keen to rectify it. Soon she felt bold enough to join in his little game, drawing his attention to a group of elegantly dressed females sauntering along the opposite path, arm in arm, laughing and joking as they went. And what story do you imagine for those ladies, Mr. Hayward? Mr. Hayward looked towards the smart little group, only to have his gaze coolly returned by one of their number, unblinking and direct.
I'm not sure they are ladies, or at least not of the kind you would be expected to know.
He lowered his voice to explain. They are women of the town, I'm afraid.
The more discreet of the sisterhood are allowed to walk in the gardens, providing they behave respectably. Mary glanced quickly back at the women, who strolled onwards, unhurried and unashamed.
Lord, sir, I can certainly say I've seen something of the world tonight. I should never have known them if you had not explained. They look like women of the highest fashion.
Yes, they are very much at the upper end of their trade. Evelina meets a similar group of ladies in Miss Burney's book. Do you remember?
I must disappoint you once again. I've tried to read Miss Burney's books, but I'm afraid I could never finish them.
I'm surprised you should not like her, for in many respects she is exactly the author for you. A sharp mind, a keen idea of right and wrong, a great curiosity about how people behave. But now I come to think of it, she rather reminds me of you.
You make her seem so severe that I'm not sure that is much to my credit.
Not at all. She has a delightful wit, which is the most pleasing aspect of her work.
Now I know you're making game of me. I can't imagine why you think I merit such a description.
No, you would not see it, replied Mr. Haywood, but I do. And as you aren't accustomed to acknowledging your most attractive qualities, I consider it my duty to remind you of them from time to time.
With that, he smiled, and they walked on together. Mary said nothing, but inwardly she exulted. He had paid her a compliment. How could that not make her happy?
She arrived at the supper box reserved by Mr. Gardiner with the greatest readiness to be pleased, and it did not disappoint. It was a spacious booth, for their use alone, set into an arcade which faced onto the central square of the gardens. As such, it offered an unrivalled opportunity to indulge in one of the favourite activities of the place, watching the other visitors as they promenaded about, arm in arm, desiring nothing so much as to see and be seen. When this spectacle paled, there was the box itself to admire, decorated with several handsome painted murals.
"They are painted to designs made by Mr. Hogarth,"
Mr. Gardiner observed, leaning to look more closely at the design behind them.
"This one is the Milkmaid's Garland, I believe. It must be older than me and has suffered from the ravages of time and stupidity. People will touch them, often with greasy fingers, but you must admit they are still very fine."
Mr. Gardiner had prudently tipped the head waiter handsomely enough to ensure their supper should not fall victim to the garden's famously meagre way with portions, and, as a result, the plates of ham served to them were thick and juicy, their chickens large and golden, and the blackcurrant tart that followed handsomely topped with cream. In short, thanks to Mr. Gardiner's carefully bestowed largesse, their supper was everything they could have wished it to be, and everyone was full and happy as the plates were cleared away. Darkness had fallen properly now, and Mr. Gardiner took out his watch and turned to his wife.
"If I'm not mistaken, we are about to witness a very remarkable event."
A clock struck 9, a loud whistle blew, and at that precise moment, every light in the gardens was instantly illuminated. Small tapers hanging in the trees, large lamps by the paths, each one lit up at the exact same moment. Gasps of astonishment and a ripple of applause greeted the success of the undertaking, which impressed even the most sophisticated visitors.
"They do it every night,"
said Mr. Gardiner, highly satisfied at seeing a difficult thing well done.
"Apparently, it has never been known to fail."
Mr. Haywood was explaining to Mary how the trick was achieved, by means of cotton wool fuses and very accurate timekeeping. She was listening with the greatest attention when, looking up to sip her coffee, she noticed a young man hurrying eagerly towards their table. When he reached them, he called out to Mr. Haywood with a friendly familiarity.
"Tom, I thought it was you. I spotted you from afar. Have been calling your name this 10 minutes or so. I was obliged to run away from my companions to seek you out."
Mr. Haywood rose, smiled in recognition, and shook the hand of the young man, who looked expectantly at the party round the table.
"May I introduce you all to my friend, Mr. William Ryder? We studied the law together some years ago. Mr. Ryder, may I present Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner,
various small gardeners, and Miss Bennet. As Mr. Haywood named everyone at the table, Mr. Ryder bowed to each of them, even the children, which made them giggle behind their hands. At this, he bowed to them once more, accompanying his flourish with an exaggerated wink, which, as he had intended, provoked even more delighted laughter. Unperturbed, he turned to the rest of the table, addressing them with the greatest good humour.
"I beg your pardon for interrupting you. I hope you will forgive me for trespassing on your privacy, but your little circle looked so inviting, I could not resist approaching you."
"We are always glad to meet a friend of Mr. Haywood's," replied Mr. Gardiner. "Will you join us for some wine? We shan't be staying a great deal longer. The lights have been lit, which means it is best for families to take their leave quite soon, but we have time to offer you a glass if you wish it."
Mr. Ryder, it appeared, did wish it, and in a few moments he was seated amongst them, a rapidly emptying glass before him, chatting in the liveliest manner. In the course of a quarter of an hour, his hosts learnt he had been in the country for the last few months, that he usually lived in Brook Street. Here Mary could not help looking towards Mr. Haywood, who inclined his head gravely at this news, and that he was a great frequenter of the gardens, visiting them whenever he could. His conversation, though it did not allow much opportunity for others to interrupt its flow, had that transparent willingness to be pleased that rarely fails to recommend itself to its listeners. It did not take long before Mr. Ryder had secured an invitation to take tea at Gracechurch Street the following week. As he was preparing to take his leave, his name was called from a little way across the grass. Mary looked up. She knew that voice. There on the path, staring towards the gardener's box, with a look of barely concealed indignation, stood Caroline Bingley. As their eyes met, Miss Bingley allowed herself a chilly nod of recognition. Beside her stood her sister, Mrs. Hurst, and her sister's husband, neither looking pleased. "Ah, I see I am summoned," murmured Mr. Ryder. He made his goodbyes and was quickly borne off by his friends, Miss Bingley giving a last toss of her head, which left no doubt of her sentiments at having been deserted in such a way. Her gesture was no doubt intended to leave everyone at the table feeling a little affronted, but Mary could not help believing it had been particularly directed at her.
"How extraordinary to see Miss Bingley again," Mrs. Gardiner remarked as they left their box. "It was not very well bred in her to be so standoffish, especially when you consider she has been entertained in our house. But I am more affronted than surprised."
Mrs. Gardiner looked as if she might have enlarged on this theme, but it was plain that Mr. Gardiner had on many previous occasions been compelled to listen to recitations of Miss Bingley's faults, and for all the love he bore his wife, he was not eager to hear it again.
"Your friend is certainly a prodigious talker," he said hastily to Mr. Haywood,
in an attempt to change the subject.
"I imagine that must be an asset to him in his profession."
"It might have been if he had persevered with it," replied Mr. Haywood. "But he did not finish his studies. I don't think Ryder was born to be a lawyer."
"So how does he support himself?" asked Mrs. Gardiner.
"He has some money of his own, and he's related to a great lady in Kent, who makes him an allowance that enables him to live as he wishes."
"I wonder, sir," asked Mary, suddenly seeing in her mind the pieces of a jigsaw coming together. "Is Mr. Ryder's benefactress by any chance Lady Catherine de Bourgh? My sister Elizabeth is related to her by marriage, and she is well known to other friends of mine. I wonder if that is how Mr. Ryder came to know Miss Bingley. If he is a favourite of Lady Catherine's, they might have met at family gatherings in Derbyshire."
"That could perhaps be the lady's name," replied Mr. Haywood, "although I cannot quite recollect it." Mary was about to ask more, when it occurred to her that even as a subject of conversation, she had no desire to introduce Lady Catherine's baleful presence into their happy circle. Now it was dark, and as Mr. Gardiner had suggested, the gardens had begun to take on a character not at all suited to the presence of families. There were more young men about than Mary had noticed before, and the smart, bold-eyed ladies, whose occupation she now fully understood, paraded with unmistakable purpose around the colonnades. It was time for the gardeners' party to take their leave, and as they traced their way back to their carriage, through the winding paths, illuminated with thousands of tiny candles, Mary found herself again walking alongside Mr. Haywood. As they were alone, she felt herself able to indulge her curiosity about his friendship with Mr. Ryder. "If you and Mr. Ryder no longer share a common interest in the law, may I ask what continues to draw you together as friends?" Mr. Haywood shot her a quizzical look. "You do ask the most extraordinary questions. You told me earlier I displayed an interest in human nature, so here I am, seeking to extend my knowledge." He turned away to hide a smile. "I'm not sure I shall tell you. I think you will laugh."
"I'm sure I shall not."
"Well, then, the truth is, it was poetry which brought us together. We read it tirelessly when we were students, anything to distract ourselves from the tedious burden of torts and case law. It was my passion, I believe, that drew him to it," continued Mr. Haywood. "I cared for poetry with an even greater intensity then than I do now, if you can imagine such a thing. But I sometimes wonder if I did Ryder much service in encouraging him to share my dedication. I am not persuaded it was entirely good for him." Mary drew her coat around her. The night was growing damp. She picked her way carefully along the path, avoiding the wet grass.
"I'm not sure I understand. Why should it have harmed Mr. Ryder to be introduced to something he came to love?"
"For a nature like mine, which is, I suppose, essentially settled and steady, poetry was like a great noisy thunderbolt," replied Mr. Haywood. "It woke me up, alerted me to feelings I did not know I had, or certainly had not the words to describe. I don't doubt I'm better for what it has taught me. I'd be a far duller creature without it."
"You could never be dull," thought Mary fondly. "I have never met anyone who less merited that description."
"But I think poetry had a very different impact upon Will," Mr. Haywood continued. "He was already of a lively and volatile disposition. He needed no further encouragement to give way to his feelings. He has never put a check upon himself, never stood back and tried to think rationally about what he wants. His heart has always ruled his head. I fear the poetry we read together only encouraged this tendency, with results that have not been wholly beneficial to him."
They walked a few more paces in silence before Mary spoke. "That seems a heavy responsibility to lay solely at the feet of poetry. Perhaps if Mr. Ryder had been obliged to follow an occupation, had been compelled to apply himself to some useful purpose, he would have learnt different habits."
"I've often thought so," agreed Mr. Haywood. "The comfortable situation he enjoys has not, perhaps, been the best friend to him. The world has largely delivered to him what he wants, with very little effort required on his part to achieve it. He is used to obtaining what he wants merely by asking for it, although, I must admit, the asking is always done in the most charming way imaginable, so that it seems a pleasure to indulge him if you can."
They were nearing the limits of the gardens now, and Mary could see in the darkness a queue of visitors making their way through the gate into the streets beyond, where lines of carriages stood waiting. Suddenly, Mr. Haywood stopped and stood still.
"I confess I am ashamed to hear myself talking about a friend in such an unmanly, ungenerous way. I do not know what can have provoked me to say such things. In my defence, I can only say that I speak to you with a freedom I would not extend to anyone else. It is very easy, perhaps too easy, to tell you what is in my heart. I hope you will not blame me for it."
"I could never do that, Mr. Haywood."
"And I am giving you a very partial picture of Ryder. His impulses are generous, and there is no malice in him."
"I am glad to hear it," she replied,
thinking nothing at all of Mr. Ryder and only of his friend. As they stood amongst the shadows of the darkening trees, she longed to reach out and take his hand. For a heartbeat, she thought he was about to do what she could not. But at that moment, her aunt came hurrying back towards them, declaring that Mr. Gardiner had found their carriage, and would Mr. Haywood like a ride back across the river?